Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And this is The Food Fight, a frank discussion of food culture featuring Australia's top chefs, producers and experts.
We'll chat about real issues and go places others won't.
This podcast travels throughout the country and we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather and speak.
And we pay respect to elders past, present and emerging.
This one's a remote small bites episode. We're talking about how this lockdown's affecting the industry, about Simon's recent review in Good Food magazine, and we both give a bunch of tips on how to improve your cooking at home during this lockdown.
We could fire away with another small bites episode of The Food Fight. We don't do this very often, but we're doing the old remote podcast.
Desperate times.
Desperate times. We're not allowed. Well, number one, we're not allowed to be in the same room together. And number
two. That's only because of COVID.
Number two. We're about 300 kilometres away from one another. I managed to, a couple of days before lockdown started, I came down the coast, down the south coast to Browley here, just 15 minutes south of Batemans Bay for the weekend. And then on the Saturday, the lockdown was announced while we were down here. So we basically stayed down the whole time. Feel very lucky to have avoided what now looks to be a very long lockdown. I think they've extended it to the 30th now.
Yeah, another 2 weeks.
To the 30th of July. We're recording this on the 15th, so this will come out, on Monday. And, I mean, by all epidemiological modelling, we could be in for a lot longer than the 30th. So, anyway, I'm very fortunate and very, very lucky to be able to be here on the South Coast and not in lockdown.
You bastard.
Yeah. And so how's life for you up there?
Yeah, it's pretty boring. Yeah. It's just not a lot to do. And even now with the further restrictions, like you can't even go shopping with two people from your household. So Bangalore is still open, so they're outside of the lockdown. I can travel there for work, but it's been pretty quiet, so I haven't been down there a lot. It's been down there once every sort of 10 days just to make sure things are going fine. Obviously, it's quite quiet. Most of my customers are from Sydney in the state. So just been hanging out in my house, really. Dog's getting a lot of walks, so that's good. But, yeah, it's pretty boring. It's pretty tough times. Like, I like working as well. Like for some people, if you like just didn't like your job, you'd be like, fuck yeah, like time off. But I quite like working. I get bored from not working.
So let's talk about sort of how, I mean, it might be an interesting, you know, I think the experience of, well, actually, let's first talk about what's going on at Night Parrot and how the lockdowns are affecting hospitality in Wollongong. And stuff, and then we can talk a bit about how it's affecting hospitality, you know, just outside, but on in a place that relies on customers that are locked down. So obviously, Night Parrot's closed. Back doing takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, compared to last time, where no one was ready and no one knew how it worked or what to do, this time everyone's ready. So we switched over to doing delivery and takeaway 5 days a week. It goes all right. Like, there's a lot of people who want to support. So especially the first weekend, sold a lot of wine, sold a lot of food. And then it sort of trickles off a little bit. It's consistent. Like, it's enough to be worth open, but it's not enough to keep you going. Like, you couldn't run a business like that. And same with most people in Wollongong. Either people have sort of shut up and been like, it's not worth it. Or they've stayed open to takeaway. So lots of great takeaway and delivery options right now, which makes things a little bit better. You can get awesome, like, Babyface are back to doing their like set menu thing, like $50 a head, which is a steal. Mm. Everyone's slinging their booze, everyone's slinging their food. So it's sort of enough to get you going, but government assistance, which is just starting to come along, needs to hurry up, really.
Mm. Have you chatted to many other people in the hospital community up in Wollongong about how they're dealing with it? See, I guess like during the first lockdown, it was really chaotic, and now everyone kind of is able to kind of slip back into lockdown trading mode a bit easier and a bit more seamlessly. You know, like, I mean, as you said with Night Parrot, it's worth being open, but, you know, like, are people as enthused about sort of supporting? You know, I remember that sort of feeling at the start. Everyone was like, fuck, hospo's fucked. Like, please support, you know, support whatever bake sale, whatever takeaway people are doing that's going on. Mm-hmm. Like, are people sort of getting involved in that sort of stuff with the same enthusiasm as they were in the first lockdown? Is it the same?
Probably it's not. I think last time, no one knew what was going on. Like no one knew if it was going to be like a month, 2 months, like 6 months, a year. Like, you know, was the world ending? Were we going to start like seeing like a Mad Max happen in real life? Like, no one knew what the fuck was going on. So last time it was a lot of, I think, and people really thought, and I mean, the reality was that some of your favorite restaurants weren't going to reopen. So there was that worry. And like that made everyone really want to get out and, you know, support their locals. So this time I think maybe less so. People still are, because people still want to eat and it's a good opportunity, but it's probably not quite the same. And also, like, first of all, it was a week, then it's 2 weeks, now it's a month, so it's kind of changed. When it was 2 weeks, I think everyone, even myself included, was like, oh, it's 2 weeks, that's fine, we get through 2 weeks, so I just chill at home, do with this, do that, keep it tight with the businesses. But now it's four, it's kind of a different mentality. Now it's like, well, shit, like, do we do more takeaway? Do we try and increase that? Like, how can we get through an extra, like 2 weeks? 2 weeks is fine, a month is huge. Like I think the cases could, it seems, from what I've read, the cases could still go up. It's the cases out in the community. So everyone just has to stay the fuck home unless they're very well protected, unless it's needed. Because we can still have quite high cases, but it's the ones that are in the community that every time there's 30 more people in the community, that could lead to, you know, 90 more people, or, you know, 120 more people. So I don't know, like, it's a month is tough. If it's more than a month, that's real fucking tough. And government's going to come to people's aid a lot more, because for workers, I mean, like, can't imagine what it's like to be, you know, a casual worker, you know, in uni, and you probably don't have any savings, and you've just gone like, well, okay, well, 2 weeks, fuck, I'll get through it. Maybe go on Centrelink, but a month, like, it's tough. It's really tough. And we've already seen the struggle of trying to get staff in this industry. And a lot of it was last lockdown, people went and got jobs outside hospitality and then didn't come back. And this time it's going to be another hit.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of, the next question is, how does this second lockdown, you know, compound the effects on hospitality in the long term? Like, do we lose more staff? Obviously, like, do we lose more businesses? I guess both are an inevitability. And another interesting question is, like, surprisingly, well, not, I don't know if it's surprisingly or not, but, like, between the last lockdown and this lockdown, there are people that have invested a lot of money into building hospitality businesses. Like, Neil Perry's new restaurant in Double Bay, which probably cost him $5 million to build. I think it cost around the $4 million mark or something.
He was flying bread in from Melbourne every day. That's not cheap.
Exactly.
I think like a lot
how
of
does, how does that affect these businesses? And I think the people's
A lot of people thought we were through, and like I mean, to be honest, I did as well. I was like,
yeah, we're probably not getting lockdowns, didn't we?
Yeah, and I mean, the government has with their vaccine rollout and their quarantine. So
yeah,
but yeah, definitely hospitality. I mean, hospitality is booming. That's the first of all. That's the one thing you hope that people have saved some from this last 6 months, where it has been really good to get through. But I mean, this does kind of wipe out any extra money anyone's probably made over the last 6 months. So everyone's going back to square one a little bit. People who, I mean, this might make a lot of questions, like, you know, Merivale buying down in Aruma, Icebergs Group buying up in Byron, Merivale buying Byron as well.
I think so.
Like a lot of big businesses have been looking at regional because it was going so well. Is this going to have a hit? Like, you know, people like, you know, if I was at Biden plans, they'd be on the back burner. People start businesses.
Yeah, an interesting thing about that regional move as well is like, if you've already invested in a region and we have a couple of months of lockdown now, like that is so much money in turnover that you were hoping to make. And one of the things that is happening during this lockdown is that vaccines are happening. And we're sort of getting, like, if this lockdown is a two-monther, we're sort of 2 months closer to being vaccinated and opening back up without that 2 months of trade and things like that. So there's a lot of facets to it.
Yeah, I mean, you hope that this is the kick in the ass that we needed, which I thought, the lockdowns in Melbourne would have been the fucking kick in the ass that everyone needed.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like,
now in lockdown again. Shout out Melbourne. Fucking
It's the seventh time or something. Yeah. Like, I know there's been a lot of short ones, but fuck. I mean, what's obviously, I've been to Bangalore, but I can't go anywhere else from there. We're accommodation, so that's a lot of our guests are our diners. So that's dried up. So we're pretty quiet down there. What's the rest of the South Coast been like? Like, are people still at the pub? Is there enough locals to see it going through the winter?
To be honest, I haven't been out that much. I'll probably get out a little bit more this weekend. I might go up to Cupid's this weekend, actually. But yeah, I've been. It's funny, hey, I become a very domesticated kind of, like, I might as well be in lockdown almost, how infrequently I go to, like, I mean, in the town that I live in, like, there's the odd cafe and things like that, but like all I do is sort of go to the beach and go to the shops and you know, go for a surf, go to the shops and cook dinner and stuff like that. I might get out a bit more on the weekend.
So, like, but freedom is just wasted on you.
Well, almost. I actually am going to make the most of it this weekend, hopefully, and do a bit of dining and exercise my privilege down here. One of the many privileges I have. It's probably a good idea for me to have a chat to some of the business owners around here and see how these things are affecting them down here. Because, I mean, the lockdown did get announced at the beginning of the school holidays, and there was a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Sydney-siders who would have cancelled their holidays and things like that. So maybe, I don't know, it might be worth having a chat to Libby.
Yeah, that was a big hit. I think that's, in a quiet time in the winter, that's a 2 week period where a lot of people come down, stay, and you bank on being busy.
Well, and not just bank on being busy like any normal year, but bank on being busy like in a booming regional tourism year. You know what I mean? So So that would have gone from high expectations to very low numbers. But yeah, I mean, I guess the switching it up a little bit away from COVID, and I don't want to spend this whole half an hour talking about COVID, but it has been interesting us talking, you know, off mic about this podcast, and also trying to sort of figure out how to keep it going through lockdown, because we have essentially recorded every single podcast that we've done in person, apart from one that we did during our first COVID lockdown. But this year we made a commitment to release a podcast every week. So me being the only one that can actually go and do podcasts, it sort of forced me to think about, you know, who and how we can keep it going, which has been fun. And I hope that the listeners out there have enjoyed the last couple of podcasts. I think the one that we released during NAIDOC week, where I got to speak to Wally Stewart and Andrew Nye, a couple of Indigenous men from down here, Walbunja men, cultural fishermen, about a serious issue that sort of is adjacent to the world of food, but extremely interesting and insightful nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably one we wouldn't have recorded or wouldn't been at the forefront to record unless you were down there thinking about what ones to do. Because it's a little bit, I mean, it's still food and it's still food chains. It's fascinating. It's something we're very interested in. But yeah, definitely is probably a good result of you being stuck down there and being like, who do I talk to?
Yeah, exactly. And well, it is something that I've had in mind ever since I met Wally. I've met Wally a few months back. Well, actually sort of towards the end of last year now, when I first met him for a production I was doing for an environmental campaign. But yeah, so I did sort of have it in my mind as something to pursue. But yeah, it's been interesting to do that. And then of course, today's Monday when we're recording, and today's not Monday, today's Thursday.
Thursday.
I thought it was Monday because we've been releasing the podcast late. That's the one hang up. But talking to Steve Folletti from Moonlight Flat Oysters has been great as well. And yeah, I've got a few ideas in mind as well for other podcasts that I'll be able to record down here. But I mean, for the listeners out there, there's a few more that that might be remote. You know, we've got a few people on our list that we might do remotely, and you might hear a bit more from Simon and I just to sort of get you through this lockdown and get us through this lockdown as well, as we're not able to sort of be there in person and stuff. Let's sort of move on. We are kind of deliberately moving away from talking too much about COVID now, but that's fine. And I guess we just want to make a quick appeal to the audience about supporting this podcast. So it's too serious of a tone for a Small Bites, to be honest, because we usually spend a lot of time just talking shit and laughing a lot, and it's boisterous and fun. But like, we need support, guys, anyone listening. And that the appeal that we're going to make, it comes in a couple of forms. Number one, if you want to advertise with this podcast, please get in touch with us. It'll cost you fuck all. And we will give you some really good advertising to a market that is exactly you. So if you're involved in the hospitality world in any way, shape or form, if you're a commercial distributor, if you're a wine sales rep or whatever, we need advertisers in order to keep this podcast going. Simon and I have been doing this for a long time, and we've made dick all money out of it, and we've done it as a passion project. But it is, and slowly will continue to get to a point where it's becoming not only financially but also time expensive hobby and passion project that will eventually become unsustainable unless we can support it financially. And then secondly, if you're none of these people and you don't want to give us any money,
if you're a nobody, then
please go to Apple Podcasts, give us a rating, subscribe, and write us a review. We need to spread the word. So a part of this effort for us to try to make this podcast sustainable by making a little bit of money out of it is a bit of a change. We are teaming up with a podcast company called Acast, and we're moving the platform over to them. They've got the resources and the personnel and that sort of stuff to help us along the way to try to make this thing sustainable. And we're moving it over there. So after this episode, you are going to start hearing an ad at the beginning of the podcast and an ad at the end of the podcast. Hopefully that's not too annoying. That doesn't mean that we're making any money out of it, but it's all a part of this journey. So we still need your help, and Acast does sort of give us that credibility and that platform and that functionality allows us to sort of move this thing ahead.
Gives us the potential to turn it into something where we can make a bit of money off it.
Yeah, well, the funny thing about it, Simon, is that when I first started the Quicksand Food podcast, with the first episode of that would have been a part of the Southern Highlands Cookbook in 2016. When I first
are you Australia's longest running food podcast?
I was about to say that. I think that I am.
I think you might be.
Who has been doing a food podcast since 2016? I don't know. Maybe Lee Trinlam has. I don't know. I don't know how long that's been
going. Maybe.
But I started this podcast in the middle of 2016, about July 2016. You can scroll all the way back. That's why we've got almost as many episodes as Anthony Huckstep, who's seems to be doing them daily.
In the past week. in 6 years.
It's funny because when I started this episode, like I had no this podcast, I had no idea of how to do it and stuff, and everything's actually kind of changed since then. So the way that we did it in the past was I have a podcast plugin that I put it on my website and it goes through that. But what I've realized now is that everyone uses these podcasting platforms because they, you know, they allow for better sort of analytics and insights and all that sort of stuff, more detail in all that stuff. I can't find any of that on my website. It's useless. I can get analytics, but they're not very detailed and aren't as useful as they need to be. And nowadays everyone's on a platform like Acast or Wooshka or something like that. So it's the sort of the natural thing for us to move over. And luckily I've got some friends at Acast who are sort of putting us on this accelerated plan to help us get some advertising and monetize this thing. So please, yes, we do need your support.
Yes. Uninterrupted content between advert at the front, advert at the back, party in the middle.
Exactly right. All right, Simon, that's enough about that. We've got to move
I'm not sure if you realized recently, Stefan, not sure if you saw or not, pretty sure Bangalore was in the Good Food magazine.
That's right. Yes,
that was you might not. If you haven't seen it, I probably have it lying around here somewhere.
Yeah, reviewing Good Food magazine. Big old Tezza came in for his second meal with Jill.
Tez and Jilly.
Tell us about let's give the mofos out there the inside scoop. So were you there the night that Jill and Terry came in to do the review?
Yes, cool. I was on the pans.
So what did Ronnie recognize him or something? Ronnie said, "Hey, Jill and Terry."
Well, we definitely know what Jill Dupree and Terry Durack do. Like, I mean, some restaurants have their like photos up on the wall with like what they drink, what they like, what things they
really.
Things they, yeah, honestly, like I've I saw. Oh, that's pretty, especially in you know, 2-3 hat star kitchens. That's pretty common. Actually, I saw the one that Mama Fuku had up. Someone took a picture of it recently, and that had all the reviewers who their partners were. So at the time, it was like, this is Pat Norse, see him if you're Rigby. This is Miffy Rigby, see him Pat Norse. This is Jill, this is Terry, they're together. Jill likes this drink, Terry likes that wine.
Really?
So like, yeah. So I mean, we don't have that.
What was that? Was that the Mama Fuku one?
That was Mama Fuku, but most top-end restaurants would have it. And this is why, like, a lot of restaurants will Google all of their bookings, like Google their name, see, like, I mean, you know, likely they'll know who the restaurant reviewers are, but you want to check who you want to know who. It's like top high end restaurants. If you've got someone who's got time to do this, they'll Google everyone's name so they know, you know, as much information about you as possible, like, you know, where you work, where you're from.
Really? You know. So do they do that just for the top end restaurants? They do that just for every customer, or for are they kind of doing that just in case there's like a VIP that they want to pay special attention to, or is it like we just want to know? I mean, I'm just some fucking chump. Like they'd Google me and be like, oh, we like whatever. He's not worth our time to send him some extra food or be nice to him or whatever. You know, like
pretty much. Yeah, they want to know who not to give to. I mean, more so in Europe, Michelin star restaurants, because like they've just got the wages are cheaper and you've got more staff. But like if they can find out that it's your birthday or not, like, you know, via Facebook or whatever it might be, and they can Imagine you go to a restaurant, you haven't told anyone it's your birthday, and then they, at the end, they bring out a little thing that says happy birthday, and you're like, what the fuck? Oh my God. Like that's huge. Like that will be, that would assume you going back. So a lot of restaurants Google, like, will, you know, yeah, Google people, and, or at least check their email address, see if it's a work email, see where they're from. Hmm. So yeah, I mean, we know, like, so Jill and Terry had been in before. Jill wrote an article in Financial Review about us. So they'd been in, they really enjoyed, promised they'd be back. So we were sort of obviously hoping and waiting. So when they show up at 7 o'clock on a Saturday, you're kind of, you know, all ready to go.
It's game on.
Game on. Let's go, boys.
Were you happy with, I think one of the things that I would dread if I owned a restaurant or was the chef or whatever, I would dread them ordering badly. Like not ordering the best dishes on the menu.
And yeah.
One of the people that we actually we talked to Joel Bickford about this, like, way back in a previous episode that people can go listen to, when they first reopened Aria, and Callan Boys, it was like the week that Callan had just done their review, just done his review or something like that. We sort of asked him, how did he order? And he said, fucking well, like, he ordered every dish I would have wanted him to order, you know what I mean? So how did
Terry promised me the first time we come in that he'd have the feast menu when he came back, so I was hoping he'd have the feast. Didn't have the feast. He ordered pretty well. Like,
you anything kind of, anything on there that you wish he had have ordered that he didn't, or that they didn't?
Had a very nice duck dish on, which I was sort of hoping he had. So they ordered pretty simply. I'm not sure if that's on purpose. So we had a little Murray cod dish with daikon and ginger and samphire. It was really tasty. They had that. They had a little kangaroo carpaccio thing, which I know Terry really liked from the time before. So I was happy he had that again. Then they had the beef and the fish. So
bistro,
like, meal. Yeah. So not like, I mean, and there's lots of snacks, little cool snacks on. I think they did. Did they have any snacks? They didn't have any snacks either. So they ordered very simply. So I'm not sure if that's kind of on purpose, because you can't have a restaurant needs to be like, every dish needs to be good. So and yes, you're going to have ones that are better, that are worse, but you can't really bank on people just having your best foot forward. And if you can't bring every other dish up to that level, then you're not going to be two hats if only half your menu is that level.
Of course.
So, like, I think I read something Terry wrote ages ago, and he said he's yet to see a restaurant go from, you know, one hat to two hats from the time he walks into the door to the time he sits down and has food, you know.
Yeah.
So this kind of, this whole thing of like, I tend not to worry about it too much. Like, I mean, we never knew who was coming to review us at Cavo, because we never had any of the sort of big reviewers come and review us. So and we never spotted anyone either. So we just had to, you know, go out and fucking cook good food every day, really. And that's all you kind of can do. Yes, you definitely want to be there. Yes, you don't want it on a day where the fish hasn't come in, you're on the last little bit of beef, like, you know, your staff are sick. Like, you want them to come on a good, you know, at the right time. But it is what it is. But yeah, they were really liked the beef. That had a good shout out. That was from Target Creek, local farm in Kangaroo Valley. So that was real cool for them to get a shout out in there as well.
What kind of beef is that? What'd you have?
So it is, they are Angus Limousin cross, which Limousin's a French breed, which has smaller bone structure. So there's smaller cows, but there's like more yield per weight.
That was the one. Is that the one you were getting via Vincentia Butchery?
Yeah, yeah. So they yeah, cool. Or Majorita meat supplied from Erica down there. That she's awesome. Just gets us the best stuff, like, from these tiny little farms on the South Coast and Southern Highlands. Like, to the point where sometimes I want, like, Target Creek got an Instagram page and has a name, and I can tag them and say about them. But then half the farm she uses, she's like, oh no, it's just Steve up in Southern Highlands who has 100 ducks every year, and that's all he sells. Like,
that's pretty cool.
It's so small. They don't have an Instagram or any way of actually, like, knowing too much about them. So, like,
that sounds like a European sort of thing to me. I don't know if I'm right or not, but I just have this perception that, like, in, you know, some random province of France, like, you'll have you know, really a high quality restaurant in a small town, and local means yes, old mate just has fucking 50 ducks
oh,
out
yeah.
here, or yeah, whatever, yeah. and he doesn't have an Instagram yeah. page, and you know, mm. yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, it's kind of the people we use are so small, and they're all you know, organic, free range, practice regenerative agriculture. So everything we want. So those guys are awesome. And yeah, short rib, big fan of, because you can kind of like, you know, when you get braised beef, and sometimes it's like stewed and it's kind of mush, mm. has no actual hold to it, and it just kind of like it flakes apart. But you're like. Like
I know exactly what you mean, because you can't bite into it and break across a fiber. Like you just kind
yeah.
of mushing it up further in your mouth and then swallow
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and if you did put a fork to it, it would just kind of go splat, and yeah. you end up with like meat strands. So like, I don't normally like that too much. And like unless it is like a stew, but like for like a nice plate of food. So short rib's really good because you can get it to a place where it's not a steak. It's not, you know, medium rare. It's very much. Well done, but it still has a little bit of pink to it, still a little bit of color, is soft but has enough bite and texture.
What's your methodology?
We do a little 50-50 salt, sugar, dry brine for like 6-7 hours, and then bag it, cook it 72 for 24 hours minimum.
Fuck. Yeah, right.
And then it just comes out like all the fat's rendered, but the meat's not mush. So it just comes out really nicely. And it's still like when you cut into it, it still has a little bit of pink blush.
What are you finishing on?
So this is finished over the char grill.
Yeah, okay.
Give a little bit of something, and then it's like cooked off the bones. We use the bones to make like a little glaze to give it a little lick. We've had that with some artichoke, some pine mushrooms, and native thyme jus.
Yum. So,
good dish.
Yeah. So, what score did you end up getting back to Terry?
So we went and bloody got a 15 out of 20, which yeah.
So what is a 15 out of 20 in Good Food magazine mean, as compared to a 15 out of 20 in the Good Food Guide mean?
So
a bit confusing.
A little bit. So. They're independent, and obviously from talking to Miffy as well, the restaurants and the scores that Terry gives are Terry's scores and his restaurants he wants to go to. So, but then in the Good Food Guide, everyone has to agree on it, and the reviews are different reviews. So, I would say we would have someone else come in anonymously who would review us for the Good Food Guide. So, consistency is key. But I mean. In the ratings on the paper, 15 is one hat, but it doesn't mean you necessarily get a hat in the guide. Mm-hmm. But it means when Terry came in, he felt we were at a one hat level. Okay. Just encouraging after 8 months.
Well, I think that it's worth noting as well. Like when you started at Bangalore, like. I don't think, from talking to you, it wasn't like, I want to get a hat as the executive chef here. It was like, no, let's build a dining experience that suits this place and, you know, and that is, you know, aligned with your style as a chef and will make us money and keep customers coming through the door, not necessarily, let's try to get a hat. So that's encouraging.
Yeah, I kept telling everyone we weren't going to get a hat. So... I look like an idiot now.
Let's hope you don't get a hat, so you don't look like an idiot.
I always think like cooking specifically for a hat is dangerous. Kavala very much did that, but we were confident that we were that level, and obviously we had worked that level. So it was just a sort of change of the food and the style. So yes, we were going for a hat, but Bangalore. The style is a lot more relaxed. It's not tasting menu. It's sort of like share plates, done well, good ingredients, cooking things properly, which, you know, is tough to get. That's not traditionally hat material. And there's not many restaurants with that style that have a hat. Like Nomad is a great example. They do it so well for fucking 200 people a night.
Yeah.
It's insane, but yeah, like, and that's kind of the vibe we were going for. And I mean, other restaurants that are similar, maybe like Chiswick, who haven't had a hat. I think it might have had it maybe a couple of years ago they had one. So it's not the type of restaurant that traditionally gets a hat. So we didn't want to make that our focus. And obviously there was a lot to change. Like, we changed the whole dining experience there, really, from service to the food. Our team's completely evolved. So it's, especially initially, it was like, you know, year one, we're probably not going to be ready or be there, but you know, things move fast. Our team's really looking really strong. Food's looking really good. And I think Terry just sort of got what we were doing there and enjoyed what we were doing there and sort of understood that although we don't have some of the same frills as some more fine dining restaurants, everything we were doing was still of a very high quality. Mm. Even though the window dressing was slightly different.
Yeah, I don't know. It just must be a good feeling to, you know, get a bit of affirmation that you're kind of doing the right thing and
yeah,
you know, that. And I think that your point about not chasing hats, but just not chasing, I think that your point about not chasing hats is a really good one. It's like, if you just, like, if you have this expectation of yourself as a chef to produce quality, like whatever you're doing, then
yeah, and you can't predict good things come. You can't predict what the good food guy are going to like. So you just got to cook. Just hold yourself to a standard, cook good food, and then hopefully they like it.
Yeah. So what are you drinking, Simon?
I saw you with a beer. This is the art of conforming. Yeah, it's Tempranillo from McLaren Vale. I did like I realized I had no like cheaper red at home the other day. Everything was just a Speno. So if I came home like drunk and wanted to open a bottle, I had nothing. So I did a bigger order from drinks from those guys in Sydney, of like interesting stuff, less than $30. So I've got all these random wines I don't actually know too much about that I've been going through. So it was either that or open some Speno stuff just to look at your face.
There's a couple of things here. I like the idea of buying wine to drink when you get home drunk. I like that. I like the fact that you bought your drink to get home drunk, wine from drinks. That's good too. But it raises a question. What is, I'm going to go under a $20 bottle, bottle available broadly, that is like a Simon Evans recommended wine that is like very satisfactory.
Under 18, under let's 20
go,
is let, tough.
Let's go under 30. Yeah, I know. Under 20 is tough. Let's
yeah.
Go
under 30. I think so. I'll give you my little scale. If you spend less than 15, someone's probably getting ripped off, unless it's massively mass produced. 15 to 20 is a gamble. You could get something quite good, the Punch Brothers way, or you could get something that's shit. 20 to 25 is generally solid. 25 to 35 will be really good. And above 35, unless you're into wine, you probably don't need to spend that much. So again, like normally the best value are wineries who have good wine. They're like lower tier. So that most people have like, you know, like their top tier stuff, and they'll have some lower tier, which will be blends, etc. Or younger winemakers with grapes that aren't that usual. So I mean, it's a Tempranillo from McLaren Vale that you see a bit of, but not that much. So it just means they would have been able to buy it fairly cheap, make good wine of value. And I think that was like $25. Also, I think some of the biggest bargains, Airlie Bank, which is made by Punt Road, like it's their second level, they're just steals. Like I think they retail for like $22 to $25. There's like a Pinot, there's a Skinsey White, there's a Cap Franc, there's a Sav and a Sparkling, and they're just awesome. Just really well made from good grapes by a great winemaker. And they just do the job.
Well, that's good to know. So Airlie Bank, Punt Road, what price range are we looking at for that range?
I think they're around like around $25, I reckon you can find them. But also like if you go on to like almost the best thing to do, especially if you don't know that much about wine, go on to Drinks, really good, DRNKS, or Different Drop is another really good website. They just have great wine across the board, and you're not going to get a dud. So just go in there, filter by price, $25, see what they've got, get it, and you're not going to have a bad wine. Like I'll check their websites out to, you know, find new wines or wines I haven't seen before or heard before. Like they, you know, they've got a whole team of people doing it, and they're not in the business of selling cheap shit. They're there for quality. So like go on their websites, you'll find plenty. You'll find some under 20. You'll find some stuff in that 20, 25 mark, and you really can't go wrong.
Cool. Well, there's a free advertisement for Different Drop and Drinks. Yeah. If you work for Different Drop or Drinks and you're listening, how about paying us for some advertising? We'll say whatever you want us to say.
Or I'll start advertising Dan Murphy's instead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great idea. All right. Well, I mean, everyone's locked down and people are cooking at home, and we thought we'd talk about a bit about what our favorite things to cook at home are. And the other thing that I want to get to are some of the little tips, some of the little, our favorite little special tips and cheat codes for cooking our favorite home cooked meals. We've kind of done a little bit of this in the past where we've talked about our favorite, like we have done when we talked about our favorite dishes to cook at home. And I think yours was roasting a whole chicken. And mine was, I mean, it's a bit of a cheat hack itself, but it's like shucking an oyster for someone and handing it to them.
It's like
a pretty, it's a pretty good way to get on someone's good side. So what else have you got? What else have you got for us this week, Simon, for favorite things to cook at home? Or let's give some people some inspo and some tips on what to cook during lockdown.
So I have one really good tip, which generally fucking blows people's minds when they try it. I might have alluded to this before, but if you buy a good chicken, even just like a good chicken from the supermarket, just like not a shit chicken, and then you do this little trick, people will lose their mind about how good this chicken is. Because everyone overcooks chicken, like everyone, all the time, especially if you roast the whole chicken, so weird shape. So my little trick is you get a Ziploc bag, good quality Ziploc bag. You put your chicken breast in the bag. You can put a bit of oil, a little bit of herb, a bit of salt and pepper if you want, or you just leave it as is. And then you get a pot of boiling water, zip your bag up, get the pot of water to the boil, put your chicken in, put a lid on, leave it boil for 1 minute, turn the heat off, leave it for 20 minutes, and you've done like a ghetto sous vide cooking of your chicken. And it comes out like beautifully tender, succulent, cooked properly pretty much every time with that technique.
A whole chicken breast?
Yeah. Because you're trying like to chicken.
Do you finish it on a grill or something like that after?
Well, yeah, if I was doing it with skin on chicken breast, and I just finish it in the pan to crisp the skin up.
Is it possible to do like a 60 degree egg in a similar fashion or something like that? Has anyone tried to like, because I mean, you can kick a 60 degree egg for an hour, but like, can you drop a 60 degree egg in boiling water and turn it off and let it stand for 3 hours or something like that? Or
doesn't take that long. So what you do, I can't remember exactly, it's not 3 hours. It's like maybe like 40 minutes. So what you do is you, Heston Blumenthal has a recipe for this, which you should be able to find.
But
you
basically, what does he know though?
What does he bloody know? I'll tell you. So he fills water up to like in a saucepan to about a finger above an egg, boil it, and then you put your egg in, put the lid on, turn it off, and you wait for a time, and you'll get similar to like a 63 degree egg.
Cool.
Same thing. So I mean, I'm not sure if Heston came up with that before I came up with the chicken one. Some might say plagiarism on his part. I'm not sure.
I think so.
We'll leave that to the listeners to decide.
Everyone knows the famous Simon Evans cooking chicken method. Well,
we used to always do that chicken cooking method in our cookery schools at Cabo. So
yeah, right.
A lot of people have been taught that.
People froth them out. They love
it. Yeah, it's just like everyone overcooks chickens. You actually have a properly cooked chicken for once.
Chicken breasts are actually notoriously shit, aren't they? Like I actually wouldn't. I mean, I fancy myself as a relatively good cook, And other than like pounding a chicken breast into schnitzels or like cutting it up into small pieces for a curry or, you know, something like that, I don't know what how to just cook a chicken breast in at home and make it good. Unless I'm like stuffing it with something or flattening it and rolling it or chopping it up into small pieces and stir frying it or whatever. I don't know how to do that.
Well, the thing is, the chicken's so versatile is that people, and generally it's not that tasty if you buy shit chicken, that you have to cover it up in a sauce or, you know, wrap it in something or stuff it with something rather than just enjoying the natural taste of chicken. Got another meat tip for you.
Yeah, let's do it.
For steaks, so it's beef, lamb, pork as well. Pork, you could fuck with this. When they come, when you buy them from, I mean, unless you're buying them, even if you're buying them from a butcher, they're going to be a little bit moist, a little bit wet when you get them, and they've been wrapped up or they've been packed. So you pull them out, they're very wet. So trying to get a nice sear on a steak then is very hard because there's moisture. So if you can plan ahead, if you're like, I'm going to have steak tomorrow for dinner, put your steak just on a plate in the fridge, unwrapped, leave it overnight. If you can turn it halfway through, all the better. And you basically do like a sort of very quick, basic dry age. Or a minimum you drying the edge of the beef out. So when you sear it in a pan, you'll get really beautiful caramelization.
That's a great tip, and I think that that tip extends to a lot of other meat. Any you've famously given that tip for your whole roast chicken recipe. The same goes for fish. If you want to get a nice crispy skin on a piece of snapper or something like that, just a bit of time in a fridge. And I think that people are extremely apprehensive about putting stuff in a fridge uncovered. I think that people like think that putting something in a fridge uncovered is like really bad. And I don't think that really is the case. Like it maybe can be, depending on what it is. And you might you know, like if you want to put an uncovered fucking half tomato in the fridge, like my housemates might, then it's gonna go off very quickly,
Dig.
you know.
Yeah.
But when it comes to stuff like that, it's actually, yeah, very useful.
What have you been cooking at home?
Well, see, okay, so I always end up eating a lot of seafood when I'm down
Yeah.
here on the South
That's
Coast
good.
because
I think people don't cook seafood much at home. So when they do get it, they're unsure of what to do with it or what to pair it with.
And I'll sort of move on to the broader stock topic a little bit after this, but well, actually, no, it's probably best to start with the stock topic. But making your own stocks at home is just going to elevate anything that you put stock in, like leaps and bounds. The shit that you buy, if you buy Campbell's stock from the supermarket, or if you buy powdered stock, I'm not too sure about some of those sort of boutique-y stocks you can get from delis and those sorts of places. I don't really buy them and I don't really use them. But like, for example, the chicken stock that comes in a carton, like if you buy a liter of Campbell's chicken stock, it's vegetarian food. Like
Yeah, a lot of them
it's,
are.
yeah, like none of them are made
It's
with,
chicken flavored.
exactly, none of them are made with chicken. So, you know, like if you're buying chicken or fish or beef or whatever it is, and it's got some form of bone to it or whatever, then take those bones out and make a stock. And that particularly pertains to like the way that I eat fish and the way that a lot of people like would be great for a lot of people to do with fish is buy a whole fish. Even if you want to eat the fillets, teach yourself to fillet a fish. Buy a whole fish. It'll cost you know, you'll pay a third less if you're buying it whole than if you're buying straight fillets. Fillet it yourself, eat your fillets, whatever. Have a nice night. But also keep those bones and do yourself a favor and make yourself a stock. Because and you can, you know, once you've done it, get some little containers of some sort and fill them with your stock and put them in the freezer. They'll last a lifetime. And the beautiful thing about stocked, like, is that it's not, you don't have to sit it out on the kitchen bench to defrost it. You just put it in a pot and put it on the stove. So whether you're making a risotto or a soup or a little hot pot style thing that I made the other night, anything your heart desires, when you've got frozen stock on hand, your cooking is going to be so much better. And then to relate this to a recent dish that I made the other day that's almost like a cheat code, I cooked this just like a prawn and chorizo Spanish style dish with some cherry tomatoes and Israeli couscous and I used some prawn stock. And you know, like if you want to be really quick about these sorts of things, fine. Buy your prawns, cook your chorizo, add your cherry tomatoes, put some Israeli couscous in there. Like, it'll taste fine. But if you want to make it taste really good to the point where people are like, the people that you're feeding are like, fuck, that was really awesome, all I did was bought whole prawns, peeled them, like cooked them off in a pan and added half a bottle of white wine and cooked that for, you know, 15 minutes or something like that. So I just had this intense prawn white wine and added it back in at the end when everything was coming together. And it just made for such a fucking tasty dish. And it's such a simple move that made it 10 times better than it would have been if I didn't utilize the flavor that's in those prawn shells. And it ended up costing me the same amount, you know, because peeled prawns end up being a lot more expensive than unpeeled prawns. And you get so much goodness in those shells.
Like, yeah, prawn heads are like, they're as useful as a prawn meat, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think another good tip is if you're not confident with filleting a fish, or if you can't be bothered to peel your prawns, you can buy fish bones and prawn heads from a fishmonger.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the like other thing is that you can go to a fishmonger and ask them to fillet a whole fish for you and give you the frame. So that's even easier. You can sort of.
Yeah, exactly.
And they won't charge you any more to fill it in.
Yeah, like if I buy boxes of prawn heads from the butcher if I want to make a bisque or a stock. So it just comes in a big old box of frozen heads. So it's not, they're not throwing that out. They'll have a box about the back. So you can ask for them. So you could buy cooked peeled ones, and then you could be like, "Do you have the heads? Like, can I buy some heads as well?" So if you want to save the time, if you're not confident in filleting a fish, you can still get hold of these things. But yeah, same thing. I did some prawn pasta the other day, and I just roasted the heads off, wine, topped it up. Like, also it's really good. I had like some parsley stalks in the fridge. I had like a fucking shit bit of celery that had been there for too long, half an onion that I was never going to use. And this is great to use up stuff in stock.
What was it that you cooked a prawn pasta recently or something like that? What did you cook recently? You had another prawn?
I just thought I had prawn pasta. So I think this is kind of shopping well. I think chefs do this quite well, even at supermarkets. It's like just finding the stuff that's good and stuff is shit. Like, you can get better pasta at like Coles or Woolies. It's not normally in the pasta section. It'll be like a sort of more of a fresh food section. And you can get like some much better linguine. And it tastes like homemade pasta rather than like mass-produced strings. So like, if you just, and it's not even much more expensive either, really. So like, you can just get like slightly better stuff, which will make your eating experience better. And like, it's all from supermarket. I got some frozen raw prawns, defrosted them, shelled them, made a stock. I was wandering around Coles or Woolies, whichever one was that, and I saw some like tinned crab, and I was like, I'll give that a go. That was pretty good. Then there was some like lumpfish caviar. So I was like, it was in like a tin, but it was just cooked white crab meat. Right. And I was like, it was like $6. And I'm like, that's quite cheap for 250 grams of crab or something. So I was like, I'll give that a whirl. So I love trying stuff out. And there's some like lumpfish caviar. So I made myself some like Coogee Pavilion baller, this kind of like, well, we have Coogee Pavilion at home. This is the version I made. It's like prawn, crab and caviar linguine. With like a just a stock that I cooked the pasta in.
Do you like that lumpfish caviar?
I mean, like, yeah, it's like it's salty and a little smoky. Like, it's not like you wouldn't be doing bups of it, but yeah. But like, I just put it through my sauce at the end. So I think I use like an egg, a little bit of cream, my stock, and like I cooked the pasta. I finished the pasta in the stock and then put a bit of that into my mix that back through with the caviar, flaked the crab in it, load of prawns, big old fucking bowl, delicious.
It was really good, was it? It sounds
like I mean, it wasn't like, I wouldn't put it on a restaurant. Maybe if I made it smaller, it was like a fucking big plate of food. By the time I'd done it, it was fun. But yeah, so I just made stock, cooked my pasta in it, real simple, and it was just, you know, a lot tastier than buying in a jar or not using those heads.
Okay, another question for the home cooks out there, Simon, and this is one that I think is people fuck this up way more than it needs to be. Mm. How do you cook rice at home?
Oh, fuck. It's contentious. So different rice calls for different measures. So if you want fried rice, like Asian fried rice,
yeah, so you've got to leave it a day. Fried rice, no one cooks fried rice fresh, right?
No, you have to cook it in a steamer, a rice cooker. Yeah. Like, you have to cook in a rice cooker if you want Asian, like Asian style rice. Sorry to generalize Asia as a continent, but that style of rice, neat, like cook it in a rice cooker. There's no better way than the rice cooker. That's literally the best way. And then if you want fried rice, you need to like chill it down overnight, dry it out a bit, use it. If you're cooking, I cooked a biryani the other day. So Indian rice dish with spices, nuts, fruits. Delicious. Like, absolutely love it. So what I do there is soak the rice in water for like half an hour. I keep just giving it a stir around and changing the water if you need to, so it's not milky anymore. It should be clear. And then you want to make sure you really like fry your rice off before cooking it. So not like deep fry, but like a decent amount of oil. Get the rice in there, get it cooking, get it stirring. So you just get like the tiniest little bit of color. Same with the risotto actually as well. You want to give that rice just like the tiniest like sort of translucent kind of glow to it. Like you'll just see that it'll be from that stark white to more of like a matte white color. Then once you've got it there, then add enough water to hopefully cook the whole thing. Give it like a couple of stirs and then let it simmer and try not to stir it.
Yeah, right.
Because if you stir it, you just break the rice up, leaks the starch out, and that's when you get really gluey rice. If you do that, you should be able to get pretty light, fluffy, separate grains. And that's the key. When you're making like rice for Indian food, you want separate grains to it. It doesn't want to be sticking together. No. So frying really helps them stay separate.
Yeah.
But it's really easy to fuck up rice, and so many people still do it.
Oh, man, so many people fuck up rice.
I still do this to this day. As a professional chef, I still just cook too much rice. And you need to have like a bigger pan to less rice. If you try, if your rice is like more than like 2 inches in the pan, like when it starts to cook, you're fucked. Like, it will just go gluey and messy and rubbish, and you'll have a bad time. Your partner will leave you. You'll probably lose your job.
Yeah, you'll get cancelled.
Like, you'll be cancelled by the chef community. Like, bad things will happen if you do that to your rice. Saying that, I still do it occasionally. Like, I did it the other day, and I was like, I've just cooked so much rice.
It's so hard to cook a small amount of rice. So do you want me to give you... I've got a few rice tips. Let me throw in my rice tips. Number one, a lot of people out there, including myself, I'm enjoying experimenting with different kinds of rice, partly for the health reasons. And one of those types of rice is brown rice. Please, anyone out there, you know this already, if you've tried to cook brown rice before, remember it takes 10 times as long to cook fucking brown rice as it takes to cook... Mate, it takes so long to cook brown rice. Like, I feel like almost all the brown rice that anyone ever eats is undercooked because the person forgot how long brown rice takes to cook, and then just went, fuck it, everything else is ready and I just want to serve this meal, so I'm just going to serve the brown rice as it is. Like, rice isn't supposed to be a really cumbersome thing to get your teeth through, you know what I mean? And brown rice has, like, it has roughage to it, it has fiber to it, and husk and things like that. And I personally, and I hope some people agree with me out there, the longer I cook brown rice, the more it sort of takes on the texture of white rice, which is actually a texture I prefer, but brown rice has a different flavor and it has, you know, some nutritional benefits and all that sort of thing. So if you're cooking brown rice, cook it for longer and just remember that it's going to take a lot longer, because the amount of times that I've stood at the fucking stove with everything else ready to go thinking, when the hell is this brown rice going to be cooked? Too many to count. I've learned that lesson. Yeah. Don't make that mistake.
Go plenty of liquid with lots wild rice or brown rice or poor barley. Like, it'll take up lots of liquid.
Yeah.
I think it kind of, like, might be a bit of a weird analogy, but I'm going to roll with it. Like, it should almost be like a similar texture to like a grape, where there's like that little bit of resistance on the outside because you've got the husk. When you actually bite through it, then it's soft.
Yes. That makes sense? That makes sense. Yeah.
We'll roll with that.
So this is my other tip. I don't have a rice cooker anymore. I'm sick of rice cookers, and I feel like my method of cooking just your standard sort of medium grain or jasmine or whatever rice produces rice cooker like results.
Yeah, you can still find them.
So what I do now is I get the biggest pot of water that I have, boil that, put as much or as little as nice salted water, put a bit of salt in that water too, as much or as little rice as I like. I basically cook it like I'm cooking pasta, cook it until it's like just before finished. And then in a sieve or a colander or a whatever water and solid separator device, like a sieve or a colander you've got in your kitchen, I pour it into that with the water so it drains, and then I put that sieve over the pot so it's sitting in the pot, if you know what I mean, like, you know, touching the edges and in the pot, and then I put a lid over that, or I put aluminium foil over the whole thing, so it's kind of sitting in this chamber. So I've got rice sitting in a sieve in a chamber of steam. And I just leave that for 10 minutes or however long I need until I need to get the rest of the meal together. And by that point, it's steamed and finished cooking and it's dried out, and you just put it in a bowl and sort of fork it, fluff it apart with a fork, and it's just fluffy and awesome. And I mean, all it means to me is that I just don't have to worry. Like, it never fails. I hope people can kind of picture what I'm looking for, but it never fails.
Yeah, I mean, you're par cooking the rice and then steaming it.
Yeah, and
so I mean,
it just works every time. I don't need a rice
cooker. I mean, that's in essence that's what a rice cooker does. Is you start with water, then the water goes, and it just finishes by steaming in its own juices.
Yeah. Exactly. But I don't know. I just hate getting out of rice.
I think it's like, as kitchen gadgets go, it's like the easiest one to.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It doesn't take up much space. Like, I think if you're a dab and at the rice cooking like yourself, then all good. But for beginners, two hands on the rice cooker at all times.
They are good.
Yeah, I think once you've graduated from the rice cooker, you can take a step towards your method. But beginners, I'd say use a rice cooker.
Yeah, see, they don't like my methods because they don't understand my methods. But let's move on to finally, and we say this with every Small Bites podcast, but we should do a follow up to this one as well, because there is more to talk about. But tell me about your air fryer, the viral sensation that everyone everyone's using these days. I don't have an air fryer, never used an air fryer, don't know why an air fryer is good other than some of the things that you've told me. Tell me about the air fryer.
I'm glad you asked, Stefan. The Hot Chef 2000 air fryer comes in the size of 26 liters. That not quite sponsored by them yet. So air fryer, I was dubious as well. I was like, fuck, is this just a new kitchen gadget? But I tried one. I Googled what they actually are. So it's a small compact oven with a heating element and quite a powerful fan. So it's just like a very efficient oven. Like there's some bollocks about the fan pushes like the natural fats of the food around, which makes things sort of fry. They're not really frying. So air fry is a bit of a lie, but chips come out very good. Like frozen oven chips come out much better in an air fryer. So that's the first thing that hooked me.
Well, from what I see online, and this is mostly from WorldStar Instagram, because they tend to have a lot of air fryer videos. It's like most of the shit that people are cooking in air fryers are frozen stuff that's normally supposed to be deep fried.
Yeah, exactly. So like it doesn't, like chips are pretty good. I love me some chips. So I was like, well, that's good. But like you couldn't get a bit of fish, put it in some batter, and then chuck it in your air fryer. Like it would just make an absolute mess. So it has to be like pre-done stuff to cook. But once I read about how it actually works, I was a little bit intrigued. So
how does it work? Tell me more detail about how it works. So it's got a fan. How hot can you get it to?
So you can get them as hot as an oven. So I think my one goes up to like 230, 240 degrees.
And what's but the it will get of hot. The fan?
So the fan means it circulates the air more. So you get a more even, consistent cook all round. Like the fan in an air fryer is going to be more powerful than your oven fan, and the oven is a much bigger unit. Mm. So like an air fryer will get up to temperature in like a few minutes, whereas your big oven will take like 10, 15. That's what everyone always bangs on about. Preheat your oven because like a normal oven at home takes ages to heat up, especially somewhere like this, just like gas ones and shittier ones. So an air fryer, obviously depending on the size, I've got a pretty big one, and that just gets hot real quickly. So a couple of things that have been really good, root vegetables. Like I cooked like a big old bit of pumpkin, it'll be like a quarter of a Japanese pumpkin. And it cooked in like 15 minutes and it was perfect. Like to the point where after 15 minutes, I was like, oh, that's getting a bit caramelized. I hope that's cooked in the middle. Probably not though. And I put my little pokey knife through it and was like, holy shit, that's perfect. And it was beautifully caramelized, just really nicely roasted. And it took, 15 minutes, where in a normal oven, that would take like 30, 45 minutes. Mm.
Okay.
And it was perfect. The other thing
do you reckon Brussels sprouts? It's a good time of year for Brussels sprouts. If I halved some Brussels sprouts, put a bit of oil on them in the air fryer.
Yeah. Blanch them first, I'd say, with sprouts because they dry out. Yeah, I did something the other day, actually. Blanch them for like 3-4 minutes, pull them out, and then I normally roast them in a pan, but yeah, in an air fryer. But the same thing is like if you put them in an oven, there's a bigger area to heat. So if you put like your blanched sprouts in there, it's just going to take longer to brown them. In an air fryer, it's smaller, the fans are going, so all the air is going everywhere, and you just get a browning, you get that Maillard reaction a lot quicker.
Mm. Okay.
The other thing, and I haven't experimented this yet, but I have a feeling that an air fryer might be the perfect oven for cooking souffles in.
Ooh, shit.
Because one time I put some like shitty frozen chicken tenders in, like awful things. I'm not ashamed to admit it. And when they came out, they had like puffed up because it was obviously like reconstituted chicken, which is like mainly oxygen. So it's this chicken that's just like fucking got like small oxygen pockets in, and because of the hot air, that had all expanded. So these little chicken tenders had blown up to these big old fucking chubby things. And then I was like, oh, bloody great. I've got bonus chicken here. I've got more chicken than I originally bought. What a bargain. And then they swiftly deflated to absolutely nothing, which is the last time I bought those things. But that's the effect you want.
Sounds abominable.
Yeah, they were. And they were worse coming out of this. But either way, the whole fact is that lots of hot air expansion. I'm like, that's perfect for a souffle or maybe meringue. I need to do some experiments. Maybe I'll do it.
Okay, do some experiments. Report back on the next Small Bites podcast. I think that's enough. You got one more quick note.
Old mate from Mr. Wong's, Dan Hong.
Oh yeah.
He obviously likes an air fryer. We're air fryer buddies. He did like a rack of lamb the other day.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it came out looking bloody awesome. Mm. It might be on his Instagram. Unsure, but it was on his story. But yeah, looked great. So definitely has some applications to be used.
Cool. If you want an air fryer, if you like air fryers, get into air fryers. I think we're only seeing the real start of their potential. Simon's going to report back with souffles and meringues next week. Cool. All right. Well, let's wrap this Small Bites up there. This was a quick one just to help get us through this lockdown, being away from each other. Simon, oh, how I miss you. How I miss seeing you every week. And
bloody hell, mate. Bloody hell. You've turned me to drink.
I guess everyone out there who listens to this is into food, but definitely get out there and support. Like, I mean, whenever these fucking lockdowns happen, get out there and support local businesses. If a business is doing something like, say, what Andy is at Babyface, or what any business is doing, where you can pay $50 and get a 3-course meal, you know, at home or whatever it might be, you know, even cook at home stuff or bottle shops or bake sales or whatever, like, they're not just doing this for fun. They're doing this because it's the only way they can make any money during lockdown. And so, like, it's up to us to support them, to help them keep their businesses alive, essentially. So get out there and support them. If you thought, fuck, I'm going to just order some fucking HelloFresh shit and just cook it at home, or I'm just going to go to my one shop at the shops this Saturday night, get some, treat yourselves. You deserve it.
I mean,
just had caviar.
You've got plenty of time to, in your day, if you're not working, to do like an old school shop where you go to Leisure Coast for your fruit and veg. You go to Cleaver and Co. for your meat. Go to Harley and John for some fish. You know, exactly. Go find like a small providor, buy some fancy stuff from two providors, and make yourself some nice dinners. And then, you know, more than one day a week, go get some Babyface food or some, you know, Soko or Buddy Kneading Ruby or Night Parrot or whatever.
Yep, for sure. And especially those new restaurants. Like if a restaurant opened in your suburb in the last month and they're now doing takeaway, go fucking buy their takeaway, because those bastards have no money. So, go support them. Happy lockdown, hopefully. Mm. As good as it can be for you all out there. Thinking of you guys in Melbourne who are back in it again. And get vaccinated.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Done. Out.
See you in the next episode. Later.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.